Welcome. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, and this is Dying to Talk, a special four-part series on KALW dedicated to transforming the taboos surrounding death and dying. The fact that you're listening means you've already started the conversation. If you're about to sit down to dinner, consider staying tuned. The dinner table is one of the best places to have these conversations. And if you're in the car, having a quiet moment to consider what matters most may be just what the doctor ordered. If you're a bit nervous or concerned about the conversation, you're not alone. And I invite you to hang in there, stay curious, and let's see if together we can actually make this the conversation of a lifetime. I'm a medical doctor and a scientist, and for the last decade, my work and my passion has been caring for people with life-altering and life-threatening illnesses. Today, I'm a member of the palliative care team at UCSF, and there I have the opportunity to support patients of all ages, talk with their families and with their doctors to ensure that the care that matters is the only thing delivered. My work has given me a unique vantage point to appreciate not only how devastating life and death can be in the absence of talking, but even more importantly, how inspiring and profound life can be when we do talk. This became increasingly clear to me when I began to help care for my own father as he approached the end of his life. These conversations only become more important with two new laws that go into effect this year. In California, the End of Life Option Act, also known as the Right to Die, will become accessible for many, though not all, people with terminal illness. And thanks to a new Medicare ruling, healthcare providers will now be encouraged and reimbursed for the first time to sit down with all of their patients to develop an advanced care plan every year throughout the year. I invite you to join me, to listen with an open mind, to share your questions and experiences, and to learn that when we talk about death, what we're actually talking about is what is most important in life. To begin this conversation, I've invited Dr. Jeffrey Mandel, the first hospice and palliative medicine practitioner I ever met. Jeff, you introduced me to this work and changed the course of my life. You and I met just after my father died, and somehow, in your presence, I had the ability to speak freely. How'd you do that?
When I talk to people about emotionally charged issues, I have to do something called joining. And joining is something that you do quickly when you're talking. It's a process of making eye contact and doing active listening and letting the other person know you're really there with them. So that encourages them to trust and connect with you in a way that allows you to really begin to talk at a deeper level. And with you, it was really easy because you were so ready to talk and so easy to get you to talk about your deeper feelings.
I want to ask you, you mentioned making eye contact as one of the first features of joining. And obviously, we're on the radio, so while you and I can make eye contact, I wonder if there's another way we can make sure we join with people who we can't make literal eye contact with, but is there a virtual way you think we can do it?
Yeah, I think there is, and it has to do with connecting with what we're saying. If these subjects are meaningful and you think that we're talking to you, then that's a way we join with each other.
Perfect. So in keeping with that, I want to go a little deeper with you. You know, in addition to being a family medicine physician, in that practice, you focused much of your career on caring for people at the end of life. And at the same time, you have spent much of your life experiencing life with either a life-altering or even a life-threatening illness. You've shared with me specifically that you were diagnosed with cancer four times, first in your early 20s before you became a doctor, and most recently now in your 70s. What has helped you, or what's prevented you from thinking about your own mortality?
Well, when I was very young, I was 23, I was just scared, and I really didn't know what to expect. And so I was talking to surgeons, and then the surgeon said, you need to have a radiation oncologist to get radiation treatments, and I just followed directions. And you know, it never occurred to me to have any kind of other kind of conversation.
Was any family involved in your care? Did they come to any of your appointments?
I was married at the time, and she came to one of my appointments when I had had the surgery. But my parents or none of the other members of my family were involved. I never really connected with the doctors that were treating me. I was just doing what they told me to do, and it was okay. I mean, because they said good things. They said, you have a kind of cancer that we can cure. And so the radiation was meant to cure the cancer and prevent it from returning. Unfortunately, 11 years later, I had a cancer. My cancer was testicular cancer. And the first one was called a seminoma, and the second one occurred unexpectedly after I was a doctor already. And it was an embryonal cell carcinoma, which is a much more virulent, aggressive kind of cancer. And I was, advised to have it removed, and then I had to have some surgery to be sure that all the lymph nodes in my body were free of cancer. And this was in the days prior to MRI scans, which now do that job, and the surgery is unnecessary. So I had a very painful and debilitating surgery, and no one yet was talking to me about what to expect. There were no conversations about prognosis. There were no conversations about what to think about and I wasn't encouraged to get in touch with my feelings about that. As so often happens, and I've seen it in my practice, people who are frightened and feel out of control do things that can be self-defeating. And I certainly did my share of that. Finally, I did get into therapy and deal with the issues that I was having and the fear that I was living and looking at how I behaved as a result of that.
So at what point in your life, and either through your practice of medicine or through these experiences, did something begin to shift where you could perhaps approach the way that we think about and communicate these diagnoses so that you could start to integrate it into your life and how to live your life?
Well, my therapy helped a great deal in that regard, and it also helped me in my practice. I found that the thing I liked most about practicing family medicine was talking to people. And I would spend much more time than I was allotted to flesh out some of their feelings and talk about their medical and emotional issues. And my nurse was knocking on the door all the time and trying to say, hurry up, because I had a schedule. But my pleasure in medicine has been interacting with patients. And it became a natural thing for me when I was presented with the opportunity to do hospice medicine and to work with people in nursing homes. And these people were all dealing with advanced illnesses and end-of-life issues. And so sitting down with someone oftentimes right at their bedside, I was able to interact with them in ways that was good for them and was good for me.
You know, it makes me think about the first time I had a conversation with someone about end of life and wishes at the end of life. And it was actually with my father, and I was 7 years old. And my father was quite healthy. He was not nearly at the phase of approaching the end of his life some 35 years later. And yet my father, for no particular reason, simply said to me, "You know, Dawn, I want you to know that I don't want any extraordinary measures taken to prolong my life. I would much rather the money and effort spent be used to support my grandchildren's education." And while I'm quite certain at the age of 7, I had no idea what extraordinary measures meant, and I had no interest at that time in becoming a physician to figure out what it meant, I was much more preoccupied with his comment that he was certain he would have grandchildren that needed supporting, and that meant that I was going to have to be a mother. But what struck me and what I'm reminded of is how naturally this conversation flowed in my family, and that he modeled that for me in a way that this wasn't something we waited to have when someone became sick. This was something we talked about just as matter of course, like we would about what are you looking forward to studying in school. And I wonder if you can recall a conversation like that for yourself when you could realize, like, oh, this is just having this conversation.
Not really. I think you were very lucky to have the family you had. In my family, we didn't talk about our feelings unless it was anger. And it was just not a safe place for me to talk about how I was feeling.
How about with your patients, though, and particularly when you talk about being in the nursing home and that this became a natural and comfortable environment for you? Can you recall sitting at the bedside and having that kind of conversation?
Yes, I did that frequently. And I became a little famous for, you know, getting into bed with them, which was simply sitting on the bedside. But it's important to be close to the person you're talking to, especially as they might be a little hard of hearing. And I find that sitting as close as I can and making eye contact and even holding their hand enabled me to elicit a lot of information and feelings that they were having that no one talked to them about.
And what was the response when suddenly you were allowing this conversation?
Well, it was almost joyous. I mean, they would smile and they would cry and they would squeeze my hand. And it was really made it worthwhile doing what I was doing.
Well, I know I am grateful that you're doing what you're doing. I want to let our listeners know that this is Dying to Talk, a special KALW series aimed at transforming the taboos around death. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, specialist in hospice and palliative care, and in this first episode, we're talking about what it takes to break through and begin the conversation about death. A difficult, sometimes scary conversation, but as we've just heard, one that's ultimately about what matters most to us. My guest is Dr. Jeffrey Mandel, a family medicine physician practicing hospice and palliative care here in the Bay Area. I do want to let listeners know that although I and my guest are physicians, the information provided in this show is not intended to substitute for professional medical advice. This is truly a conversation for everyone, and we welcome your questions and experiences. If you want to begin these conversations with a loved one but are scared or worried, we want to hear from you. What are the obstacles you face? What stops you? On the other hand, if you've had success in having these conversations with your loved ones or with your own doctor, how'd you make it happen? What have you discovered? You can call our toll-free number at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can email me at dawn@dyingtotalkradio.com. That's dawn, DAWN, like the sunrise, at dyingtotalkradio.com. You can also find us on Facebook at Dying to Talk Radio or tweet us at Dying to Talk FM. We'll be right back after this.
Hey, everybody. This is W. Kamau Bell, host of the new live talk show, Kamau Right Now.
There was a woman waiting for the bus eating like a head of red cabbage raw. Just, I think they say if you see something, say something. I want to say something. I don't know why.
You can't parking lot pimp on the people of Oakland. Parking lot pimping was born in Oakland. You know what I mean?
NATO, white people. How do we solve the problem of white people?
I don't know if you know this. Just on a global level, white people are outnumbered. Nationally, that's coming soon. And white people are freaking out. Like the Who in a hotel room, we are trying to smash up the place on our way out.
Well, we've got more lined up for 2016. January 21st at the New Parish in Oakland, February 18th at the Swedish American Hall in San Francisco, and March 17th at Impact Hub in downtown Oakland. You can find tickets at kalw.org, which is also where you can sign up for our podcast.
This is Dawn Gross at Dying to Talk with KALW. I'm here with my guest, Dr. Jeffrey Mandel. And we are excited to hear from you as well as to continue our conversation. And Jeff, I wanted to ask you about what it's been like to work with doctors as a physician before you became a physician, since you became a physician, in particular, since you started to focus your practice on end-of-life care and serious illness. And what have you noticed in the way that doctors have communicated with you and that you might hope that doctors can learn to do differently?
It's been really clear to me that doctors set up barriers to talking about difficult subjects, emotional subjects, subjects that are not something they normally experience with their patients. It's also very time-consuming, and their tight schedules in the medical practice office leads them to want to control the time and how it's being spent. So I always found that it was difficult to ask questions, much less talk about things that were emotional. And now, with the advent of electronic medical records, people are talking to their patients with a screen in front of them, and they're typing, and they're looking at the screen and typing, and then they come back and give a glance to the patient and ask a question, and then they go back to the screen and type. And I find that in the way of conversation, I find that in the way of joining, I find that not conducive to being able to really talk to that person. So here I am at age 72, and I was getting treatment for my most recent cancer, and I listened to the doctor for some time, and he was giving me medical facts, and I asked a few medical questions that he responded to, and was, you know, he was typing and looking at his screen. And finally I said, "Can we just talk a minute?" And, you know, he looked away from the screen and turned his chair, and we made eye contact. And, you know, I got a chance to ask some questions about prognosis and what it was going to be like to go through treatments. And it was the beginning of being able to talk with someone. And it was with a surgeon, of all people, who are not trained to talk to people.
Well, let's be careful now. One of the best palliative care doctors I have been privileged to know is an orthopedic surgeon who's cared for me, and some extraordinary conversations have come directly from him. He's taught me a great many things. So yes, we have stereotypes, but I also want to be in the business of busting myths and taboos here. So I wonder, how do you begin a conversation? You just talked about a way that you encouraged a physician to begin one with you. How do you begin one with people in your life, whether they're your own patients or your own loved ones?
Well, once again, it starts with the joining and getting close and making eye contact. and then sensing what it is they, trying to sense at least what it is they want to talk about. And oftentimes they'll say something about an illness, and I'll say, well, how do you feel about that? And how is it affecting your life? And then I listen. I actively listen. And I find that people will respond to that usually without fear and will open up to me.
So on that note, Jeff and I are eager to listen to you. Please give us a call. Our toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-TALK. If you have ever wanted to have this conversation but haven't known how to begin, Jeff and I are eager to support you in contemplating different entry points, different approaches. There's no one right way, but we're excited to share with you some experiences we've had and to hear your own. If you've engaged in this conversation and you've discovered some of the magic and the mystery that happens when we actually talk about death, we want to hear from you. Again, you can reach us via email at dawn@dyingtotalkradio.com. That's dawn@dyingtotalkradio.com, or post on Facebook at Dying to Talk Radio, or tweet us at Dying to Talk FM. Now, Jeff, as you know, there are these new changes coming into the practice of medicine, hopefully for the better, hopefully ways to support doctors in turning away from the computer and turning back toward the people we're here to serve. And the one I'm particularly excited about is the Medicare ruling that allows physicians specifically to create visits exclusively on having these conversations, what we call advanced care planning. And I think it's safe to say that while the ruling now exists and doctors and those they serve can request these visits, it doesn't necessarily mean doctors know how to do this. And what ideas do you have for a doctor who might be facing having these conversations for the first time, how they can sit with it, and perhaps how the patients themselves can invite doctors into these conversations?
Well, one of the things is to have the doctor have an aid, and the aid is a pulsed form, which means physician order for life-sustaining treatment. It's a bright pink form that we use in hospitals and in offices and in nursing homes, and it's got all of the major elements on it that you need to have in a conversation about what your choices are for what you want to happen in case you were in a dying kind of situation. So it asks whether you want to have CPR. It asks whether what the intensity of the care you want, whether it's do everything, whether it's do almost everything but don't do X, Y, and Z. And the other is to have whether to have just comfort care in which you are treated kindly and all your symptoms are controlled, but we're no longer doing curative medicine.
I think that's a perfect segue to Linda in San Lorenzo, who has a question, I believe, about hospice and what's available in the hospital. Linda?
Hi, how are you? Hi. Hello?
Do we have Linda?
I'm here. Hello.
Oh, hi, Linda. Welcome to Dying to Talk. Thank you for calling. What
hi,
can we do?
I just happened to be listening, and I'm kind of glad that I was. I'm a respiratory therapist, and I work in the healthcare field in an acute care hospital. I've done this job for about 30 years, so I've been around a considerable amount of death and dying, and I sit on people's beds, and I hold their hands, and it's not my position in the hospital to have those conversations particularly, but when I'm led to, I do. And I'm wondering what about, there is some talk recently about an ethics panel that was going to be reviewing cases on people that really, well, they shouldn't be life-sustained. You know what I mean? It's like, how do you let these families and patients choose that when they haven't chosen it before it's a crisis moment? Is there anything working in that direction that you two are doing?
Linda, first, let me say thank you for all the work you've been doing over the last 30 years. And I really want to highlight perhaps the sense of feeling a little stuck when you say it's not my position, and yet when the conversation's in front of me, how can I not? I just applaud you and invite you to consider it's always your position, it's always your opportunity when someone is suffering and is looking for an opportunity to share. To answer your question specifically, every hospital, as far as I'm aware, and maybe Jeff, you know something further, is required to have an ethics committee. Now, just because they have an ethics committee, and for those who may not be familiar, an ethics committee is comprised of physicians from multiple different specialties, as well as lay people, and that they are brought in to discuss and contemplate different types of patient scenarios that seem to be incredibly complex. Either the family's in distress or the healthcare team is in distress about what's the appropriate level of care to be providing. And what you're describing, Linda, is not terribly uncommon, unfortunately, in our healthcare system, where we do so much to keep people alive that at some point, it is almost the cart before the horse, where we failed to have a conversation to begin with about what's most important to someone, to know what are their goals, what are their hopes for the kind of care that actually is possible with modern medicine. And the trick is, with an ethics committee, they need to be consulted. They can't just step in. Someone within the healthcare team actually has to request it, or the families can. But getting that information out to people like we are right now, I think, is one of the first steps that you, Linda, could actually raise. And the question, if you're part of caring for someone who you're worried they or their family's in distress, say, hey, do you think we could bring ethics in here to help us think this through? I think we have another caller, Rebecca in Menlo Park.
Hi, Don. Thanks so much for this program. My question is a tough one for me. My mother-in-law was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And, you know, it was at a point where there wasn't really much they could do. However, everybody in her family really wanted her to do something. And she wouldn't say, she was going along with, the chemo regime that the doctors agreed to do. But it was clear, especially as it went on, how hard it was on her, and, you know, she knew it wasn't going to help. How do you get people, once you get a diagnosis like that and nobody's expecting it, how do you get them to talk about what they really want?
You hit the nail on the head, Rebecca, and I'm so glad that you've decided to be part of this conversation. First of all, I want to offer my condolences for what your family is experiencing. Pancreatic cancer, as you know better than anyone right now, is one of the most devastating. It comes out of left field for most people. There's no way to be prepared for something like that. I think what I'd like to offer is something I heard you say, which was, it was clear how hard it was on her. And I wonder if in that type of moment, the opportunity is to actually ask her, is this hard for you? And find out what's hard. I know that we can see it and we can feel it and we can imagine for ourselves what's hard. People becoming so sick, so fatigued, they can't get out of bed. They can't do the things that we're used to them doing. The other thing that I notice, though, in caring for people is how resilient human beings are, and that we adjust to what life has to throw us. And so even as something becomes really hard, it may not necessarily be something that's unlivable. And I think that's the key, is to discovering what really matters to someone, what are the key things they want to have happen, and what's getting in the way of that happening. Jeff, you want to add something to that?
Yes, hi. I also have experienced that sometimes very ill people who are being encouraged by their worried children and other family members will not want to disappoint them and will take treatments that they might not ordinarily want to do. So once again, having the ability to ask the person with the cancer, is this what you really want? What would you really like to do in your heart of hearts? not for us, not for the rest of the family, but for you. And I think that's important to think about.
Often we find we get twixt in between what we think someone wants and what we think family wants, and we avoid actually talking about what's so, and in asking someone what really matters and giving permission for the real answer. Sometimes we need to give permission for people to let go, and sometimes people really aren't ready to let go. And looking at how they lived their life, the whole of their life, often gives us clues to how they're going to approach the end of their life. We have an email here from Boyd in Wolf Creek, Oregon. Boyd says, "Personally, I seem to welcome death, much as I have enjoyed the birth of those close to me. But the fear of debilitation and the prospect of losing control of end-of-life decisions is real. Is it true that when you enter a hospital, many of your advanced directives are voided?" Jeff, what do you think?
No, I think if we know what they are, and we have some documentation of them, then I think physicians are more and more willing to consider them and to plan their treatment program around them, so that doing highly aggressive things and doing curative things when that's not what the patient has indicated they want can be avoided. However, it also may mean that they don't get to stay in the hospital very long. And so that people in an emergency department who have a do not resuscitate advanced directive may only get basic treatment and then they're discharged. We're working on having access to palliative care physicians who can see those patients and talk to those patients about what kind of care they really need when they are not in the hospital.
I think one of the things I've also noticed is that doctors are human beings, and we have our own biases. And I recall taking care of a person who knew she was dying. She knew she had a terminal illness. And yet she really was not done being alive. And one of the questions that comes up quite often in the hospital is, as we were just hearing, do you want to be put on a breathing machine? Do you want to be kept alive if your heart stops or you have trouble breathing? And in her case, the answer to that was absolutely, even though she knew she wouldn't leave the hospital alive. And yet during her care, there was a moment where one of the doctors that was responsible for her care actually decided to change that wish, not out of thinking that he was right and she was wrong, but he really was trained in a way that said, well, that's what's logical. She's not going to survive. There's no way we're going to be able to maintain her on the breathing machine forever, so we shouldn't put her on that. And yet the fact is, she, as I said, was very clear she was living until she wasn't. And as the title of this show is, a quote from Cervantes, until death, all there is life. I'd like to read one more email from Amy in Richmond before we go to a break. She says that her mom can't stop talking about death despite being healthy in body, mind, and spirit. And she asks, I guess in a world where death is sometimes ever elusive, when old age lasts longer than growing up, how do we talk about not dying, but living while alive? And what I'd offer, Amy, is really what I just said, that this whole conversation is actually very much about being alive. You're listening to Dying to Talk, a special KALW series aimed at transforming the taboos around death. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, specialist in hospice and palliative care. And in this first episode, we're talking about what it takes to break through and begin the conversation about death, a difficult, sometimes scary conversation, but one that's ultimately about what matters most to us in life. My guest is Dr. Jeffrey Mandel, a family physician practicing hospice and palliative care in the Bay Area. As we've mentioned, Medicare is now encouraging doctors to talk with patients about advanced care plans and reimbursing them for it for the first time. What do you want to know about how to prepare for that conversation with your doctor? And if you're a doctor, do you feel ready for these conversations? You can call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or email me at dawn@dyingtotalkradio.com. You can also post us on Facebook at Dying to Talk Radio or tweet us at Dying to Talk FM. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Chuck Finney of Your Legal Rights. Please join us this Wednesday evening at 7 for an estate planning discussion of PULSE, Physician's Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment, which sets forth a patient's wishes and directives for medical treatment. My guests will be estate planning attorney Jana Ellerman and Dr. Lael Duncan, Medical Director of Consulting Services of the Coalition for Compassionate Care of California. That's this Wednesday evening at 7 on 91.7 KLW San Francisco.
Welcome back. You're listening to Dying to Talk, a special KALW series aimed at transforming the taboos around death. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, specialist in hospice and palliative care, and my guest is Dr. Jeffrey Mandel, family medicine physician practicing hospice and palliative care here in the Bay Area. And before we turn to some more comments we have, I wanted to ask you, Jeff, that what do you do when you want to talk with a friend, but you notice that they're afraid and don't want to engage in the conversation?
Usually I make some kind of physical contact and get them to pay attention to me. It may just be a touch on the arm. It may be a handshake. It may be a pat on the back. But then having made that contact, we're connected. And then I can say whatever it is I need to say about either something that's bothering me or something that I'm afraid about or something I want to go further into with them.
So with that in mind, there's a movement that some of you may or may not be familiar with called Death Cafes. It's actually bringing people together, total strangers in many cases, to talk about this subject. And Jane on Facebook says that while she sells biodegradable caskets in the Bay Area and that she's involved in a very active group called Funeral Consumer Alliances, she has held 3 death cafes, each of which were very well attended, and the questions were great, suggesting that maybe this isn't so scary, that when we bring people together, perhaps with an expectation we're going to talk about this, that it's okay. Have you ever attended a death cafe, Jeff?
No, I haven't, but I think it's a wonderful idea. I would wonder if these are, what age group these people are in. Are they baby boomers who are approaching their senior years, or is this the younger people who are interested in the subject?
You know, I've attended a version of a death cafe. It's actually put on by the Chinese Coalition of Compassionate Care here in the Northern California area as well as Southern California. And what they've created is a way of coming together under the same format of death cafes, but specifically with a facilitator and with prompts, questions that are written in a format consistent with the Chinese culture around how they approach death, or sometimes predictably, actually how they avoid talking about death. And yet when you bring people together, what I noticed when I participated is they were all ages. And one of the stunning things that was deliberately done in this format was that the prompts they used, these cards, were written both in Chinese and in English, because they recognize that you're spanning multiple generations, some of whom never learn English and some of whom never learn Chinese. So I think in this case, we actually have quite a bit we can learn from exploring other cultures and how they approach death and dying and perhaps entering in different venues unexpectedly to come together. Doug in Napa is calling.
Hey, thank you, Don. I'm loving this conversation. That's very, very helpful and wise. That's great.
Thank you.
I wondered if I could just tell a story about why I never ask people if they want everything done anymore.
Please.
So I'm a physician that I need help center, and I had this dear little Mexican grandma who always told me she wanted everything done. She loved life, she loved her family. She wanted it to go as long as possible. And one night I got called to the hospital because the nurse said she's dying. She's got to be intubated. Her breathing is too bad to go on. And I walked in, and the room was packed with family. And she was being loved on and touched from head to toe. She had sacred icons lined up. The whole energy of the room was exquisite. And I was taken aback at how beautiful this experience I was walking into was. And it turned out that she had many organ systems failing. It was close to the end of her life, no matter what we did. And so I said to her, "You've always told me you wanted everything done. Normally that means we're going to put you on life support, and if your heart stops, we're going to do CPR and electric shocks. And what I've just learned is that it's not possible to do everything, because you can't have your family touching you and praying on you like this while we're doing electric shocks. We kill your family member. We can't have your whole family sharing this space while we're doing everything it takes to run a code and intubate you and everything. So I never ask anyone now whether they want us to do everything, but more, what type of care would you want if you're getting close?"
It's so great, Doug, that what you're sharing is language matters deeply. And when we ask a phrase, as we often do, "Do you want everything done?" What does everything mean to anyone? I think if I could impart one thing for each of us to take home tonight, it's to not assume we have any idea what another person means when they say anything, that we need to ask, what is everything to you? What is important? And then we can piece together what's possible. And to your point, you can't put electricity into someone if they also at the same time want their family holding them and praying with them via touch. That those two things are not compatible. So then we have to work that through together. We have another call here with Lisa in San Francisco. Lisa?
Hi, I'm very happy to hear this program. I'm a medical interpreter, Spanish-English, and I was very happy to hear about the comment made about Chinese culture, because there's a very strong cultural element involved. And I have had the privilege of being able to work with palliative care teams at the hospital that I work, I think that they're a fantastic team. The whole concept, however, of hospice or palliative care is something that can be, that is kind of difficult to explain. I also fully agree with what the other person just spoke about. When you talk about everything, you have to be more specific about what things mean. I wanted to mention, however, that oftentimes things can be very much harder for families of different cultures and different languages when medical interpretation is not incorporated from the beginning of the medical care, but rather incorporated near the end when there has been some level of misunderstanding about wishes, when interpreters have not been used. Can make the process much more difficult for families and providers alike near the end. Oftentimes there is also much differing levels of educational levels where providers make certain assumptions about a family member's understanding of the physiology of a patient's condition. and even just basic physiology. And sometimes in the use of an interpreter can help fill gaps by alerting the provider to a possible misunderstanding of terms or of basic concepts. Like, for example, leukemia, sometimes family members think that leukemia may be just something, bad blood, which needs to be just transfused.
Yeah. Lisa, you have hit on some really key points. First of all, wanting to distinguish what hospice and palliative care in English, let alone in translating that into a different language, is very complicated. I can tell you most physicians don't know what palliative care is and really have some serious myths about what hospice is and isn't. I couldn't agree more with you about the importance of including an interpreter as part of the healthcare team from the beginning when we're supporting patients that speak in different languages than the primary healthcare team is capable of communicating in. And understanding the culture along with the language, understanding where any one person is at any given time, as you said, not only from an educational standpoint, but emotionally, how we're able to process these things are so key. So not only having an interpreter as part of the healthcare team, but gosh, if we had the funding, having the same interpreter. So you're not trying to recreate a conversation with someone who they themselves may be uncomfortable with having this conversation and may not know the words to interpret, as you said, the distinction between, say, hospice and palliative care. So I really thank you for what you're doing. We need more of you. We have an email here from Andy. He says, how can doctors strike the right balance between realism and optimism when talking to patients and their families about terminal conditions? He mentions that his mother died a few years ago from pancreatic cancer and that after she was diagnosed, that his siblings thought her doctor was terrible because they found him too pessimistic when discussing possible courses of treatment and the probability that they might help. His criticism of the doctor was that he did not try to make his siblings understand that this was an end-of-life diagnosis and that there was almost no possibility that any course of treatment would help at all or extend her life in any meaningful way. Jeff, I wonder, I mean, we've touched on this a little bit, but really helping doctors get comfortable in speaking the truth maybe is what Andy's pointing to here. What do you think?
I think doctors are shy to do that, as you have noticed. They don't like to bring bad news. They don't like to make people feel that there's nothing that they can do to help. They want to be optimistic and say, well, we can try this treatment, we can try that treatment. And I think more and more of people, particularly oncologists, are differentiating between the treatments that are curative, potentially, and the treatments that are palliative, which is meant to mean that they are buying some time and treating symptoms that are out of control, so that doing chemotherapy or radiation as someone is approaching death is meant only to make them feel better and not to cure them. I think that doctors in general are getting much more aware of that, and having palliative care teams in hospitals is making a big difference for other physicians.
And for those who don't know what palliative care is, let's just take a quick moment. So as you heard Jeff say, it's a team. So palliative care by definition is modeled after hospice, which is a specific form of palliative care designed to care for people at the end of life, the last 6 months of life. Palliative care ideally is composed of a physician, nurse, social worker, and chaplain. And if we're fortunate, perhaps psychotherapists, psychologists, as well as respiratory therapists, and ideally an interpreter when necessary. But that team's focus is on the individual who's experiencing a life-altering illness doesn't necessarily have to be life-limiting or life-threatening. And it also absolutely supports the entire family. And the key to having that team is so we can meet people where they are, wherever they are within that entire dynamic of the individual and their family.
It's also consistent with doing curative treatments.
Absolutely.
So that doctors who are going ahead and treating, for instance, with chemotherapy, may also employ palliative care physicians to help with the symptoms that some of the treatments may be causing, and being there to try to head off any kind of complications.
I'd like to share an email from Lindsay asking, what's your advice on talking to people who don't want to talk with you? Lindsay, this is a great question. She offers that the first time she filled out an advance directive that her mom wouldn't talk with her, even though she told her she had named her as the person who could speak on her own behalf. That is one of the most challenging questions. And the first thing to ask is your mom the person that really wants to be talking for you? You may need to find a different healthcare proxy or a surrogate decision maker, as we call it. The other possibility is to make a request and say, Mom, I get this makes you uncomfortable, but I wonder if you would do this for me. This will help me feel better. And I think actually it'll help you feel better too. Can we try? I want to thank you all for joining us. My guest this hour has been Dr. Jeffrey Mandel. Jeff, thank you so much for being here tonight and being a shining light in my life and so many others. And thanks to everyone who's called or emailed during the program tonight. It takes courage to want to approach these conversations. To be willing to share with others is a gift, and I'm honored and grateful for your willingness to participate. Dying to Talk is produced at the studios of KALW in San Francisco. Rosalie Atkinson is the in-studio producer, and Joanne Marr is at the controls. Matt Martin is the advising producer, and Ashley Ann Kigbrom created the promos. All of the music for Dying to Talk is by the Oakland-based band The Kilbanes. The next episode of Dying to Talk will be at this same time on Thursday, February 21st, when we'll be talking about the machinery of medicine and why calling 911 may not always be the best idea, particularly if you are frail or nearing the end of your life. To see a full listing of programs in the series and to find resources related to tonight's program, please visit kalw.org. And if you'd like to share this program with family and friends, it will be available for online listening in the next hour. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, inviting you to be curious, ask questions, and never settle. Or as a hospice patient once taught me, life is uncertain. Better eat dessert first. Who's in for ice cream? My treat.